Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Last time in class, we discussed event horizons, and we noted a couple features of them, which were that in order to define an event horizon, you basically need to know the whole future history of your space-time. And in some ways, because this event horizon is defined using the whole space-time, has this unusual property that can sort of anticipate what's going to happen in the future in terms of where it forms and evolves. And so today we're going to discuss an alternative way of defining sort of the boundary of a black hole in a dynamical setting called an apparent horizon. And basically, this quantity we'll be able to define just given some time slice. And then if we have time today, then we'll begin, after that, we'll begin discussing the gravitational waves, which we'll discuss for the rest of the week. So we want to define these apparent horizons. But first, we're going to have to introduce a couple of concepts. So let's consider we just have some time slice sigma t. So that's our just a slice of our space-time at some time. So it's a three-dimensional time slice. And then we're going to consider two-dimensional surfaces within sigma t. So let's S be some two-dimensional surface. And we're going to let QAB be the induced metric on S. And we're going to let L be A normal to S. So in pictures, you know, we have a three-dimensional space-time or time slice. We have some surface S, and we have some normal L, and this metric QAB, which is just the metric induced on the surface. Then we're going to define the expansion of the surface S in the following way. So we'll call the expansion O here, script O, and basically given by the change in this normal, basically the derivative of the change in the normal with respect to the surface. You can, so I'm not going to work this out, but you can show that this is actually equivalent to this quantity here, where Q would be the determinant of this induced metric. So in some sense, you can think of it as the fractional change in the area of Q in this direction L. So what we'll be interested in doing is making a choice where L is null. So we're interested in calculating the null expansion of this surface.
Like the derivative of in direction of Q. Isn't it the derivative in direction of Q? Like we are taking the derivative out of L and we are finding that the dot product with Q afterward. So it should be like, it looks like we are looking at the dimension, like at the direction of Q, but we are taking the derivative out of L. But that, it looks like, you know, we're taking.
Yeah, so it's a little bit non-trivial to go from one to the other.
Oh.
Q is a function. It's not directional.
Yeah, but like we can generalize the idea of the derivative, right?
Tensors?
Yeah, to tensors.
So sorry, what was that? I mean, you can have a lead derivative of a tensor or a scalar, but for a scalar, it just reduces to the directional derivative.
Okay, so we're just defining that as this. It's
yeah, so this is my definition. And my claim is that you can think of it as this way. But it's basically the change in this of L
but we can't
induced on. Hmm?
We can't take lead derivative along a tensor, only along a vector field, right?
Hmm?
We can't.
This has to be a vector, yeah.
But we cannot generalize the lead derivative to say we are actually taking a lead derivative along a tensor. We cannot generalize this definition.
I'm not aware of that. Such a.
So how are we defining the lead derivative here? Are we just defining with that, I of something plus I?
Yeah, I mean for a scalar, it's really just going to be like the same as that, right? For some scalar.
Okay.
For vectors or tensors, then you get the extra terms that'll. Derivatives there, but anyway. So.
How is Q in the derivative? I'm sorry, this is probably a stupid question, but how did it get into the derivative?
Yeah.
When you're writing the lead derivative.
In the lead derivative, there on the top.
It's
determinant.
Yeah. So anyway, maybe I shouldn't have written down this one because it's a little bit non-trivial to get this one. But this is the definition we're going to take for the expansion of the. Yeah, the null expansion. And I'll be interested in the case where L is a null vector. So we can choose with respect to the surface inward and outward null direction. So we can actually do that just so let's say our surface S, or sorry, for sigma t, we have our unit normal, we'll call it NA. And then for our surface S will have a unit normal, we'll call that SI or SA. And then we can use those two normals to define an inward and outward null. So this is the unit normal to sigma t. And this is the unit normal to S. And using the fact that this is minus one, this is one, then we can deduce that we contract our plus and minus null vectors with each other. Then we get zero. Well, obviously, if they're null, we contract them with each other with itself, then we get zero. And if we contract the plus with the minus, they're sort of normalized in a sense we get minus two.
Oh, but
here.
Isn't L the normal to S?
So it's also normal to S. So
why isn't it if L is normal to S and S lowercase is normal to S, why do we write it?
Right, so this vector like lives in sigma t. And is the normal to S that's
as received from sigma.
Mm-hmm. So S is the purely spatial vector. So it lives in sigma t that's normal to S. And then we can add a component to it that goes out of sigma t that's perpendicular to sigma t, which mainly this one. And then it'll also be still normal to it. So we have choices. So this is the null vector that's normal to it, whereas this would be a space spatial vector that's normal to it. So you can kind of think of this as like in Minkowski space, this would be sort of, you know, T plus R and T minus R.
Mm-hmm. So they also have different indices. No.
Why does it not? Why is it not? And A is not.
But L is also the same thing, right? Like L is normal to S, so S is also normal to S. And again, the same argument here would be applied here, that L is also spatial, because you know the surface that we're getting, S lives in a...
So we're constructing L out of a purely spatial part, and then a part that's orthogonal to our sigma t. Hmm?
We define another L there too. What's the difference between that L and that S? Like,
so here I just said L is any normal to S, and now I'm saying so you can define this expansion. Now I'm saying we're going to be interested in particular the null expansion, so we're going to specifically take a normal that's null. So from here on, we're restricting to null vectors. This is a simple way to construct a null vector.
For S is codimension 2, so it has two normal vectors, right?
Hmm?
The S is codimension 2, so it has two normal directions away from it. One is L, one is S. But we want to say that S is a null surface, right?
It's not a specific sphere.
S is not a null surface. S is space-like. So S lives in sigma t. So it's, yeah. So it's, yeah, but it's codimension 2, so yeah, you have the... SA is the normal, space-like normal that lives within sigma t, and then NA is the normal to slices of constant time. So we can combine these two. But yeah, so like the...
lies completely in sigma t, right?
Sorry, what's that?
SA lies completely in sigma t.
One more time.
SA is tangent to sigma t, so it's like normal to the boundary, basically, that belongs to sigma t.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a... a purely spatial vector.
So then NASA is zero. NASA.
Yes.
And it doesn't follow from this. It's a requirement. So like.
Yeah, I'm finished. If NA is like, and like NSA is tangent, orthogonal to sigma, and S is tangent.
Yeah, but, I mean, according to the story that you're saying, we have to say that N, A, and S, A, N, and S are orthogonal, right? It's not just, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, you can say this, or you can just say S, A, like, is in sigma T. All right, so, so with these null vectors here, we can then define an outward null expansion. So and if we want, we could plug in what this is in terms of the 3 + 1 variables. Plugging in these guys for L, and then, you know, basically Q is going to be the spatial metric. Then, you know, it's defined in an analogous way to how the spatial metric is the full metric, you know, plus this, you know, NA and B. So you do the same thing with, you know, gamma AB, and then you add a SA SB term, and then you get the induced metric Q. If you sort of plug through that, you can rewrite this in 3 + 1 form as a divergence of S plus the extrinsic curvature contracted with S, and then the trace of the extrinsic curvature K. So we're gonna, so now we're basically, or yeah, so we're gonna introduce some terminology here. So if on our surface S, this is less than or equal to zero, then we're gonna say S is outer trapped.
Sorry, what is that word? Outer?
Outer. Yep. Just because it's defined with the outward null vector. And then if it's equal exactly to zero, we'll say S is marginally trapped. So a lot of times you'll see this abbreviation that S is a MOTS. So that would stand for marginally outer trapped surface. And we're going to define the apparent horizon to be the outermost MOTS, or marginally outer trapped surface. So here, this outermost just means that our apparent horizon is not contained itself within some other larger marginally outer trapped surface, which is different from what the outermost means here.
So it means that just you need to wait long enough.
Sorry, what's that?
So if it's a dynamically varying surface, you have to wait long enough. That is what you mean by outermost?
Outermost is like if you, I'm just saying, if you find, like, if you search within your spacetime, you find some surface that's marginally outer trapped. But then you find another surface that contains that first surface that's also marginally outer trapped. Then the second one is the apparent horizon, and the first one is not the apparent horizon because it's not the outermost one. So we'll discuss in a second like where such a situation would arise.
And my point is that how can we know if there exists another outermost?
Yeah, it just within your given time surface.
That's,
yeah, because so all these quantities are defined, you know, with respect to some particular time, you know, sigma t. So. You know, the advantage of this definition is we, you know, have a notion of a horizon. It's basically, so sort of physically, we can think of it as, you know, if you're on the apparent horizon, you know, you shine light out in every direction. And if you're sort of outside the horizon, then that light expands outwards, the area that light increases. If you're inside, then it starts actually, gravity will pull it inwards, and the area that the light you're shining everywhere decrease, and you know, right at the apparent horizon, sort of hovering between the two.
Okay.
Yeah. And
I have this big problem to just imagine how. So, for the expansion, then we say expansion smaller or equal to zero. So we are saying that from inside outward, the null rays are going outward, but they're getting converged. But classically, we think that if they are going outward, they have to get away from each other, right? If you have a bunch of null congruence that they are going outward in radial direction. But within that surface, they are getting converged to a point. Is it?
Right, yeah, so I mean, it's like the same way, you know, if you're inside the event horizon, right, like there's kind of two null directions, but they both sort of move inward away from the, like, you know, neither of them exits the event horizon, right? So it's like the same way that, but with the kind of, you know, expansion of the null rays are on the surface. Yeah. Yeah, so... if you have a non-dynamical spacetime, it's stationary, then this reduces exactly to the event horizon. So that's good in the sense that if you have some high dynamical situation, if you wait for things to die down long enough, then you'll just get the event horizon. But this definition doesn't require you to know the whole feature of the spacetime. So for one of the problem sets, you'll work through basically a simple example of a dynamical spacetime and track how the apparent horizon changes.
Small detail, that L over there should be L plus, right? In definition of expansion of L plus.
Yes. Right. And so just a note, I mean, this definition is with respect to a specific time slicing. So you can have sort of pathological time slicing such that you wouldn't have an apparent horizon, even for example of like a Schwarzschild spacetime, have some pathological slicing where you wouldn't have a apparent horizon on a time slice, even though there is an event horizon. So that's something to keep in mind. But usually one doesn't run into such pathological cases. And then one can also define a sort of dynamical horizon by basically requiring this dynamical horizon to be foliated at each time by an apparent horizon, and then now you have some three-dimensional surface that's a function of time. We're not going to go into that. But the one example I do want to give is basically what happens to the event horizons and apparent horizons during a black hole merger. So if we consider a binary black hole merger, the event horizon actually looks like something which people refer to as a pair of pants diagram, which is so this would be sort of the time direction, and this would be the event horizon. So you have, at some point they're separated for the two black holes. Once they get sufficiently close to merge, you have this sort of continuous transition to one tube, and then it settles down to the final black hole. So this is actually a contrast to what happens in the apparent horizon case, which is that this common horizon actually just appears at some time step. So let's say you're right before the appearance of this common horizon. So you have on your time slice, you'll have the apparent horizon of one black hole, the apparent horizon of the second black hole, and then one time step later, you'll still have these marginally outer trapped surfaces. But at some given time, you'll have a common marginally outer trapped surface that encompasses both them. So by this outermost, that I require in this definition, these would no longer be apparent horizons. They're just matzes. And then there's some third marginally outer trapped surface that now becomes the event horizon.
How come you know about those two inside when the common apparent horizon forms?
I mean, you still have the space-time still defined there, right? So
no information can get out of the apparent horizon, right?
Yeah, yeah. So you can't send signals out there, but for example, you can do if you just do the calculation of what the space-time looks like, I'm saying when you search for these surfaces, those are still there. Basically, they didn't disappear from one time step to the next.
And so is there an exact time frame that these common apparent horizon forms? I mean, should they be in contact or before they get in contact with each other?
Yeah, it's before they touch. So there's actually a theorem that says that basically that these can't touch if they're apparent horizons. So before they touch, you'll have this common apparent horizon.
Can I ask something?
Yep.
So what's the difference between like these two ways of like finding it? Well, it's still like we're talking about the same process, right? It's not
Yeah. So I'm saying, here, you know, you have basically the two legs of the pants, which would correspond to the individual black holes, and then they just kind of merge together and form this common event horizon. But here, you know, before these touch, you just have a third marginal outer trapped surface that appears outside the two, and that becomes the apparent horizon. Yeah, and then if you wait long enough, this will settle down to the same thing as this. And in fact, a general property is that this should always be inside the event horizon.
Inside? Like the
Yeah, so basically if you have any trapped surface, that should always be inside the event horizon of the black hole. And that's I think a theorem due to Hawking, and assuming the null energy condition in cosmic censorship.
So the event horizon itself, is it a trapped surface, or is it like the limits, or?
Yeah. So in some sense, you can think of it as, you know, for example, in that example we talked about yesterday, where you have some shell of matter that,
yes.
Some thin shell that's collapsing down, right? So at any given moment, you can see basically if light can move inward or if light can move outward or not, right? And that basically will define the apparent horizon, right? But then there'll be some light rays that can move outward for a little bit, but then eventually will stop and never make it to infinity. And so those ones are inside the event horizon, but not inside the apparent horizon. So you can see that's kind of why we expect the apparent horizon to be inside the event horizon. Why it's kind of the event horizon is more restrictive because it's one that they'll never make it out to infinity ever. Yep.
So I was thinking, we cannot define event horizon when we have a dynamical system, because for event horizon we have to wait long enough, and we want to make sure that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you can. Yeah, so you can define this in a dynamical setting, but yeah, you just have to have the whole. You have to evolve all the way to the future, and then use that to define. To work what the event horizon is.
If you want to talk about, we want to draw a similar thing for apparent horizon, it goes like this and it expands eventually.
So it's like, you know, you have this one So yeah, it's like similar at the beginning. And then what I said is, at some time, you'll just have this larger one that'll settle down. Because, like, you know, these marginally outer trapped surfaces still persist past this point, but they're no longer apparent horizons.
Yeah, well, my point was the big one expands in eventually, right? Because it wants to reach the...
Yeah, so so if you wait long enough, these two will be the same. Once your space-time is no longer dynamical, then the apparent and event horizon will be the same. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused. What's the difference? How we're defining event horizon and how we're defining apparent horizon? Like, we're defining apparent horizon as outermost modes that we are having, but what's the definition of event horizon then?
Yeah, it's basically the... Remember, we are basically saying, look at future null infinity. Then basically take everything that eventually the causal past the future null infinity, and then the boundary of that is the event horizon, right? So basically any point where there's no null array passing through that point that reaches future null infinity, that's inside the event horizon.
Exactly. It shouldn't be the same thing that we're defining here. Like, how come these two are two different things, apparent horizon and event horizon?
Right, so it's like it's basically due to this dynamical situation here, right? Like thinking of this collapsing matter, right? So you know, if you have some matter that's like collapsing down or something, right? So if we consider this time slice or whatever, right? This is saying this point right here is inside the event horizon, because you know we can it can move out a little bit, but then it's going to hit this shell of matter, and it's not going to this shell of matter is going to keep collapsing, and then it's never going to make it out to infinity, right?
Okay.
But there's no apparent horizon here yet, right? Because just on this given time slice, the shell hasn't collapsed enough to have trapped surfaces. So you have to wait till basically, you know, it reaches r equals 2m or whatever. Okay.
Sorry, you said because it hasn't collapsed yet on that time slice, there is no apparent horizon?
Yeah.
By apparent, you mean anything that we, see?
I mean, you mean that on that time slice, there's not an outermost marginally outer trapped surface? Yeah.
Oh, we can't see that the expansion is negative everywhere on that particular time slice.
Right.
You have to wait and get another time slice at some later time. And see, oh, everything is negative, so therefore there is an apparent horizon, and also, therefore, we can see the horizon, and it's apparent now, basically.
So there's no apparent horizon yet, but there is an event horizon, is the point. Yeah. Okay, any other questions about horizons before we switch gears a bit and talk about gravitational waves?
I kind of missed the point of why this is important. Because why are we slicing? Why are we taking time slices and looking if we can detect the horizon that particular time slice or not? Why is that important?
Right. So I mean, this is kind of a local way to define where the black hole horizon. So I mean, this is a different way to define sort of the boundary of the black hole that sort of isn't a causal and doesn't require you to know about the future.
This is for finding the horizon when there's still dynamics going on, except instead of the steady state of the black hole, and then we...
Yeah. So if there's no dynamics, these give the same thing, basically.
Okay.
But for example, you know, if we are trying to see what happens when two black holes merge or something, we'd like some... there's both sort of theoretical and practical recency to this. I mean, theoretically, you can prove lots of theorems about these apparent horizons and the dynamical horizons you would form from them. But also practically speaking, for example, let's say you want to, so there's a lot of different ways you deal with the singularities inside the black hole horizon. But one of them is to basically excise these regions from your domain and use the fact that on a trapped surface, basically what that means is that information is only propagating into that surface as opposed to out of that surface. These apparent horizons, basically, by searching for them, they tell you where you can excise. So you can always excise inside these apparent horizons, because that lets give you a trap surface. That's another sort of practical use of them. OK, any other questions? OK. Yeah, so for the rest of the class, we're going to talk about gravitational waves.
A quick question before we finish the topic. Might be a little bit off the topic, but is the apparent horizon the most accurate way of defining horizon? If you have numerical data from a space-time and you want to look for horizon, even though it's not going to be dynamic, it's a stationary, for example, space-time. Would that be the most accurate way to find, to look for horizon?
So you're saying I have a stationary space-time, so my apparent horizon and event horizon are the same, what's the most accurate way to find one of the?
Find if there is a horizon and
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm not sure it would make that much difference in a non-dynamical setting. But yeah, I mean, like in some sense, you know, the way you'd find these is you start with some guess for a surface, and then you calculate the null expansion on it, and then you kind of adjust your surface, try to flow it towards a surface where that vanishes. So that can sort of well-defined ways to describe that flow. And then practically speaking, for like event horizons, you know, so like null geodesics around, like if you just start with some null geodesic around here, like it's going to be very sensitive to what you consider, right? Like if you put it a little bit inside here, it's going to go to singularity. If you put a little bit outside here, it'll escape quickly. And then, you know, it's sort of going to be extremely sensitive to the position you put it in, and to try to get one that sort of just hovers there forever, right? So practically what people do is usually evolve for a long time, and then you put null geodesics sort of at you know, around scribe plus or at very large distances, and then evolve them backwards in time. So that's kind of more stable to start with them far away and then evolves backwards in time. And then that way, the sort of event horizon is a tractor. So then they'll sort of all go and hover around the event horizon. OK, so today, I'm going to begin by talking about propagation of gravitational waves in the weak field regime. This may be partially kind of a review from your first year class. And then we'll talk about generation of gravitational waves and try to get through a definition of energy and angular momentum contained in a gravitational wave. And then hopefully we'll have a bit of time to talk about perturbations of black holes, so the quasi-neural mode ringing and how that is also manifested in gravitational waves. Just at least give a bit of a flavor of that as well. Okay, so we're gonna sort of begin in the weak field regime, where we assume that our metric is approximately flat. So we're gonna sort of do perturbation theory, saying the full metric is Minkowski plus some perturbation we call HAB, and we'll assume this is a small perturbation, and then just work to linear order in H. So to linear order, if we want to take the inverse of this, we just pick up a minus sign. And you know, so as we discussed before, we have some coordinate degrees of freedom that we need to fix. So actually, just like we did for solving the nonlinear Ansan equations, we're going to choose our harmonic gauge to make our calculations simple. So that's at the box of the coordinates equals 0. And then if you sort of work out what that means in terms of the linearized equations in HA, basically you can just take the generalized harmonic equations or the set the source functions to 0 and drop all the nonlinear terms. We get, as we expect, the principal part is just the wave operator acting on our metric perturbation. And for this linearized case, it's just the flat wave operator. So this is the trace reverse form. So if we trace reverse this, we can get the following. So I'm going to call, from here on out, I'll just call box to refer to the flat space operator. So if we trace reverse this equation, we get the following. And then we're going to call this sort of trace reverse form of the metric H bar AB. And we can note that if we rewrite this harmonic gauge condition in terms of this, we'll actually get something on that looks like the Lorentz gauge and electromagnetism. So in electromagnetism, you'll recall that, you know, even when we take Lorentz gauge, we have a, you know, residual degree of freedom. Which is that we can always add a gradient of a scalar to our vector potential. And if that scalar satisfies the box that is equal to 0, then that leaves the divergence of A unchanged. So here we have the sort of analogous thing in GR that we can make a coordinate degree, sorry, a coordinate change where we change our coordinates, and as long as box of C is equal to 0, then we still have harmonic gauge. And we're going to require that this coordinate change be in some sense small, so that we don't get too far from our original background metric. So to begin with, we're going to restrict ourselves to the wave zone. So we're going to imagine that we had something in the source zone creating these gravitational waves, and they propagated a ways out. And we're just going to look at the propagation of the gravitational waves there. So we can ignore the non-propagating degrees of freedom, like the Newtonian ones or whatever, because we're far away from our sources. And we can use our residual gauge degree of freedom to put our metric perturbation in what's called transverse traceless gauge. So this coordinate transformation will give us four gauge degrees of freedom. And we're going to use those to require that our metric basically have, whenever we have a time, all the time components of the metric, like both time and time mixed space or zero. Yep.
Can you explain again the smallness of C? Like, why do we require that? Like, how can we quantify that?
We could always have like a, because we have these coordinate degrees of freedom, we could just make an arbitrary coordinate change that would for example, it would affect the background metric, so that perhaps we started with the background metric is Minkowski and Cartesian coordinates, and then we made a big metric change, and now the background metric looks completely different. So in some sense, we're going to require our.
How does it change the background metric? I don't like it. Shift in the coordinates. I don't know. Maybe it's obvious, but.
So this is just an arbitrary, if you just imagine an arbitrary coordinate transformation, we could start with Minkowski, make some coordinate transformation that sort of doesn't go to zero when h goes to zero, and then just changes our Minkowski and Cartesian coordinates to some weird time dependent metric that still looks like that's still just flat space but in some weird coordinates.
Okay.
So we're gonna basically require that our the coordinate change we're making go to zero as h goes to zero. So it's not like introducing sort of a order one just like coordinate change.
Okay. So given that we define the h, the coordinate transformation should also respect that definition, like in the order, the first order should introduce something else.
So this is the transverse And then we're also going to require that our metric perturbation be traceless. And with this, with these requirements, then we have that this is just equal to h bar as I defined it. So now if we look at our Lorentz condition, so in general, it's that. And if we write that out, all right, sorry. Let's, if we just look at the time component of this Lorentz condition, we get the following. And we could see that basically by construction, this will be zero. And so we're just left with this one component. Yeah, sorry, I think I misspoke here. I'm just requiring the mixed time space components to be zero, not the time component. So we're still keeping that one. All right, so in vacuum, we can set this right-hand side to zero, and then we'll get the following. And so, here basically, this is saying that, we have some freedom here, but we can choose the 0,0 component to be 0, and then it should be 0 for all time, basically, because at even given time, it should satisfy this equation. All right, so then at that point, then we can arrive at the condition that our transverse traceless gauge, we're just interested in the purely spatial components of Hij. So. So this is equal to 0 for any time or space component. Okay. So so now we just have this equation for the spatial components. And the sort of general solution here is just going to be solutions of the form of just plane waves. So or And so here aij is just some constant. So let's plug in this ansatz to this equation here. Yeah, so basically we just get, with this ansatz, basically these derivatives just reduce to factors of this four-dimensional, wave vector k. And so since we want this to be equal to zero, basically this should be equal to zero, which means basically the k is null. And from this Lorentz gauge condition, we also have we rewrite this in terms of this k. We have that when we contract h with k, we should also get zero. So this is the transverse property. So to make our lives simple, let's basically choose our coordinates such that k, the spatial component of k, is just in the z direction. And that gives us a null vector there propagating in the z direction. And then we can write our constant part of the metric perturbation aij. And we can write it the following way. So I've put the, because k points in, has this component in the z direction, I want all the z entries to be zero. And I also want, I want a symmetric tensor. And I also want the trace to be zero. So that means this quantity has to be the opposite of that quantity. So basically, there are two degrees of freedom here, which I called plus and cross. So here we use that this is zero. This is symmetric. And the trace is zero. And h plus and h cross are the two propagating gravitational wave degrees of freedom. So in this transverse traceless gauge, you can convince yourself that a particle at constant coordinate location is actually a geodesic. So we can consider what happens to two nearby geodesics in this transverse traceless gauge as a gravitational wave propagates through our spacetime. So we're going to call them A and B, and say they have four position. One just sits at the origin for all time. And one is at some length L. And then what we want to do is calculate the proper distance between these two points. If we have a spacetime that has a gravitational wave in it. And so for simplicity, let's consider that we have H cross is 0 and we just have H plus. So then the proper distance between A and B is just going to be given by so the proper distance squared is just going to be given by that. So that means as our gravitational wave passes through, the proper distance between these free-falling particles actually oscillates. It increases and decreases.
So why H cross is 0?
So just for simplicity, I'm just imagining one of the H cross is 0 and H plus is the non-zero one.
Sorry, what was KAHAB 0? I mean, yeah, or DAHAB?
Sorry, which one? This?
This, yeah, the transverse. Yeah, that.
This one? So this is just, we're taking our Lorentz gauge condition up there.
Okay.
And then
right.
I can convert the derivative into pulling down a factor of K.
And you said in vacuum, DI, DI, 0, 0, 0, and then, therefore, H, 0, 0, 0. How did you get from the first line to the second line? Because you said that H, 0, 0 doesn't have any spatial dimensions because it's a small perturbation from the, I don't know. What?
Yeah, so here we're saying, first, use this Lorentz condition. We can see that we already use our gauge degrees of freedom to set these guys to 0. So when we do our, we plug in our Lorentz condition, we get that this is 0, so this has to be also 0, so that means this has to be a constant.
A constant in the respect of time.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and then here we also get that it also just needs to satisfy this. So.
What can it be the first order with respect to space H 0, 0? If it's first order, it's the second order derivative is all 0. Why did you get from? Okay,
so this is our constraint, the Lorentz condition, and then this is from our equation of motion,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
that,
yeah. Yeah. From the equation of motion, how did you get from the equation of motion to the fact that H 0, 0 is 0? Why not proportional to.
Like H at the infinity is 0, right? And then you when you plug the
infinity is 0. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it could be any constant, but we can might as well just set it to 0, right?
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we're out of time anyway. So yeah, maybe it's a good place to end here.